from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Happy New Year. This is the future. Well, it was compared to last year. So let's start the year with a future in the automobile world. The evolution, the revolution, that is electric vehicles, or as we say in the motor trade, EVs. We look at a new kid on the block. Well, I guess they're all new kids on the block, but let's look at Porsche's great new Taycan. It's electrifying this week on 30 Laps. Also, Ricardo has opted for the Kiwi and passed up on the opportunity to mount the prancing horse in Maranello. Let's get a giddy up and find out what that's all about. Sparks, Germans, Italians and Kiwis. All this week in 30 Laps. So let's kick off, shall we? From Executive Style in the Summer of 2020 magazine, we have Quick Start. The electrifying Porsche Taycan takes on Tesla with its own charisma. And this was written by Toby Hagen. If you're the kind of guy, person, I should say, if you're the type of person who likes catching your mates off guard, then Porsche's latest head turner could be just the ticket to a night or two of entertainment. And you don't have to be travelling at warp speed to unleash its best. Potter along at 30 or 40 kilometres an hour, then smash the accelerator and watch the heads smack back into the headsets from the near instant forward thrust. Yes, it really is that brutal. Up to 560 kilowatts and 1,050 newton metres in the flagship Turbo S make it the most powerful road-going Porsche ever unleashed in Australia. Comfortably blitzing the 911 GT2 RS, which is the hero of the lineup and one of the fastest cars ever to wear number plates. There's also a more affordable turbo, although affordability is a relative term. The turbo is expected to cost around $300,000 and the Turbo S around $350,000 when they arrive here late in 2020. Well, that's now. The here is now in 2021. Yet the Taycan has no engine. Instead, it utilises electric motors to deliver its ample thrust. But it's the milliseconds between stabbing the accelerator and that propulsion like it's been hit from behind that defies its very convincing performance story. Chattering of tyres as the stability control contains some inevitable wheel spin to all four wheels is the main indication there are lots of ones and zeros flying around its computer brains. The intensity steps up when you engage launch control, a mode that allows the most maniacal of takeoffs. It's virtually guaranteed to elicit some tyre slip and amps up the ferocity of that initial hit. The electric motors fed more electrons for 2.5 seconds to step power up from a regular 460 kilowatts to a short-lived 560 kilowatts in the Turbo S. What is not immediately apparent from those gut-wrenching, churning science experiments is the engineering that affords beneath the aluminium skin to ensure the Taycan continues to perform its potent party trick at any speed and with any sort of punishment. What's the secret? Well, the key is Taycan's accelerative talents is an 800-volt architecture. Engineers also claim Porsche-specific tweaks to the chemical construction of the LG-sourced batteries, all with the aim of ensuring big power and big smiles. Despite its obvious similarities with Tesla, both use AC induction motors and place batteries along the floor, Porsche has infused the Taycan with its own charisma. is a two-speed transmission, for example, that snicks up a ratio to allow the rear motor to better stretch its legs for the high-speed runs. The smaller front motor does most of the regenerating when driven hard and sends up to 265 kilowatts back to the batteries, all of which places additional heating stress on the 83.7 kilowatt-hour battery at its core. Whereas most obvious rival, the Tesla Model S, is prone to overheating with spirited thrashes, Porsche guarantees the Taycan is track-ready for even the most capable of drives. The harder you drive, the more Taycan expresses its talent. Brakes slow proceeding with similar force to the straight line go, yet there's little of the vagueness often inflicting the stoppers on electric cars. Beautiful linear steering is predictable and responsive. It's helped by a ludicrously low centre of gravity that tames body movement to the point where it remains supremely flat. Few cars leap out of tight bends with its poise and pace. There is the occasional hiccup. The centre console lid catches the driver's elbow when raised, and the transmission sometimes lets out an inelegant thunk when downshifting, but they're minor gripes for a car that nails its brief of delivering Porsche's excitement with electric thrills in what is an emerging blast into the future. Well, I think we can take away that Mr. Toby Haben was quite impressed with this car. Quick smart, the electrifying Porsche Taycan takes on Tesla with its own charisma. And that came from Drive's executive style in the summer edition of 2020.
I had this little band back home, a rock and roll band, and we was going to play this job one night, and it wasn't too far away, so we was walking.
It's a cool music for a cool car. To the Sydney Morning Herald, May 15, 2020, an article by Matthew Clayton, why Daniel Ricciardo passed up the chance to join Ferrari. At first glance, Daniel Ricciardo's new multi-million dollar contract with McLaren, coming just 21 races after he switched from Red Bull Racing to Renault at the beginning of 2019, looks like a step sideways. But if the 30-year-old is ever to achieve his goal of becoming Formula One world champion, it's a move that at least makes that possible. Ricciardo's other options at Ferrari or Renault were either dead ends or roads to nowhere. In Formula One's 70-year history, only Ferrari, 16 constructors' titles, and Williams, 9 titles, have enjoyed more success than McLaren, who've had 8, while the likes of Lewis Hamilton, Ayrton Senna, and Alain Prost have stood atop the world in McLaren machinery. Hamilton's 2008 success is McLaren's most recent, but under the stewardship of CEO Zak Brown and new team principal Andreas Seidel, the team improved dramatically to fourth place in 2019. That rapid rate of progress allowed changes in the pipeline for 2021. And that will give Ricciardo optimism that his dream is still achievable as he starts his second decade in the sport. That Ferrari elected to replace the outgoing Sebastian Vettel with 25-year-old Spaniard Carlos Sainz is a little surprise, given their penchant for backing one driver to attack the world championship and using the other to play a dutiful rear gunner. Michael Schumacher's 5-year reign as world champion from 2000 to 2004 featured Brazilians Rubens Barrichello and Felipe Massa as team-oriented wingmen, drivers capable of winning occasional races but never given the internal support for a genuine tilt at the challenge and championship. Ferrari's most recent world title in 2007 came after Massa sacrificed the lead at the final race of the season to allow team leader Kimi Räikkönen steal the crown from the warring mechanic teammates of Hamilton and Fernando Alonso. It's an approach that hasn't worked since, but one the Italian team remains stubbornly committed to, and one Ricciardo was well overqualified for. The ascension of 22-year-old Charles Leclerc at Ferrari last year and a lucrative post-season contract extension till the end of 2024 saw Vettel consigned to the second fiddle role. Had he re-signed for 2021, necessitating a significant pay cut and acceptance of the fact he was no longer the apple of Ferrari's eye, that Ferrari pounced on Sainz, who was just one podium finish in 102 races, only confirms that all eggs are now in the Leclerc basket. With 7 victories and 29 podiums, Ricciardo was a square peg that was never going to fit into the round hole Ferrari. They wanted their second driver to slot into Vettel's exit. It was only 4 years ago that Ricciardo finished third in the championship for a second time. To expect a driver of his pedigree and market value to ride shotgun for Leclerc was little more than a romantic thought for fans linking the Australian with the all-Italian background to a team that hasn't employed an Italian driver full-time since 1992. Ricciardo switched to McLaren, who he had meetings with in 2018 before ultimately deciding on Renault, will coincide with the team starting an engine supply deal with Mercedes from next year. The McLaren-Mercedes axis has a glorious past. The combinations won 78 races and 3 titles between 1995 and 2014, while Mercedes engines have dominated for the past 6 years. Since Formula One switched to V6 turbo hybrid power plants. McLaren, using Renault customer engines, leapfrogged Ricciardo's parent team into fourth place in the Constructors' Championship last season, and it's undoubtedly on the up that Ricciardo was willing to sign with the British squad less than 2 years after rejecting their overtures shows how far McLaren has come and how much potential a potent McLaren-Mercedes-Benz Ricciardo package has. It's a move that's unlikely to pay immediate dividends for 2021 for Ricciardo, with McLaren's momentum temporarily halted by the coronavirus delayed start to the 2020 season. But as the post-pandemic F1 adjusts to its new norm that includes regulations being frozen for 2 seasons and a cost gap that could slash the budgets of some teams by as much as 50%, Ricciardo has managed to manoeuvre himself to a team that seems to be on the inexorable march back to where they spent a large part of their past, and one where they'll have a chance to compete for results on equal footing to his teammate, British youngster, Lando Norris. And there we are, folks. That's why did Ricciardo pass up the chance to join Ferrari? That was from the Sydney Morning Herald. It was written by Matthew Clayton in May of 2020.
It was said of the sheriff of Calhoun Parish, not to ever touch his daughter, Anna Lee. For to look at her with the lustful eyes was certain to get you time in the penitentiary.
Yep, don't mess with the High Sheriff of Calhoun County. Talking about Ferrari, which we were just a minute ago, that funny horse that they've got on the side of all their cars, where did that come from? Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because hang on to your wallets and I'm going to tell you. I say that because most of us have never even tried to own a Ferrari, for obvious reasons. However, the horse. This comes from the website of the Museo di Marchio, which is one of the museums in Italy. Ferrari's famous rampant stallion can be traced back to 1692. It was in this year that Vittorio Amedeo II, the Duke of Savoy, founded the Royal Piedmont Regiment, one of the most glorious cavalry outfits of Piedmont and Italy. Various military organisations later, the regiment was finally to adopt fire red as its colours to be displayed on lapels, handcuffs and on stripes down trouser legs. While its insignia was a rampant stallion, more than two centuries after Italy's first airborne squadron was formed during World War I. One of the first cavalry officers to join the squadron was the famous World War I ace Francesco Baracca. In view of his military origins, he had the rampant horse painted on the fuselage of his aircraft, a symbol that was to become acknowledged as his own personal coat of arms. There is actually another fascinating story told to account for the origins of the Ferrari trademark. It seems that the fighter pilots had the custom of having their vanquished adversaries' heraldic devices painted on the fuselages of their aeroplanes. Refer Alfa Romeo. According to the alternate story, the symbol with which Baracca is so closely associated was depicted on the fuselage of his biplane after he had shot down an enemy pilot from Stuttgart, a town whose heraldic device is a black rampant stallion, though some say it's a mare. Indeed, Ferrari's engine figure displays the same upturned tail. The Porsche trademark is also adorned by the figure of the Stuttgart mare. Be it as it may, the only official painting depicting Francesco and his aeroplane was done by Ettore Grazzini of Bologna, and in this picture, or at least in the postcard his parents had made up after their son's death, the horse is incomplete as its rear end is cut out. In any case, in 1923, this symbol of speed and bravery was entrusted by Enrico and Paolina Baracca to the winner of the Circuito Automobilistico di Savio at the Savio Racing Circuit. The winner, Enzo Ferrari, for him to carry on the memory of their son who had died in combat on Mount Montello near Treviso during the Great War. In 1929, Enzo Ferrari opened the Scuderia Ferrari, or Ferrari Stable, in Modena as a mechanical car racing workshop and subsidiary of Alfa Romeo. Then in 1943, the house was moved not far from Modena to Maranello, on land owned by Ferrari. The little black horse standing only on one hind leg with its tail characteristically upturned was set against a canary yellow, the colour of Modena, background with an upper border bearing the national colours of Italy. This iconic device started appearing on all the Scuderi's productions, signs, letters and official documents, but not on the cars themselves. They continued to sport the Alfa Romeo trademark. The championship shield on the cars first put an appearance in the 1932 edition of the 24 Hours of Spa race in Belgium, in which the motor racing competition Scuderia Ferrari had entered two cars. In 1947, Enzo Ferrari began making the cars that were to carry his name. In addition to the shield-shaped trademark, a square trademark with the founder's family name was also designed, its lettering with serifs as well as spaced out, and was used as reference for the restyling of the logo type. In the first rectangular trademarks, the horse's hoof touched the upper bar of the F in the logo type. The latter logo was affixed to all Ferrari-constructed vehicles, be they saloon or competition cars, while only official racing cars sport the shield shape and in appearance-wise. In over 60 years of Scuderi's and Ferrari's mark history, the trademarks have undergone continuous but gradual and limited change. Ferrari's distinctive iconography was consolidated with the production of the House Visual Identity Handbook in 1994. The restyling was done by the Sedulius Agency. The stallion's eye was touched up and the position of its legs set right, while logotype lettering was optically corrected. And we ended up with the badge that we have today. So there you go. All the way back to 1692, hey? Bit of a history. Well, you'd expect that with a car like a Ferrari and a dancing stallion on one leg with the upturned tail. I'll leave that one alone too, I think. Moving on. While we're talking about badges and the origin of, we go to Mental Floss, which is an online newspaper. How 14 companies, car companies, got their names. It's written by Ethan Trex. There's a couple of interesting things here, so let's have a look. Toyota. Toyota didn't start out as a car company. It wasn't called Toyota either. In 1926, Seiichi Toyoda founded the Toyoda Automotive Loom Works, a company that made looms, not cars. In 1933, Toyota's son, Kichiro, started a separate motor division, and the company's cars quickly took off. How did the name get from Toyoda to Toyota, though? Well, in 1936, the company held a competition to design a new logo, and the winner consisted of three Japanese characters that made up the Toyota name. However, after giving it some thought, the Toyota family decided that the slightly tweaked Toyota was stronger. Writing out Toyota, whereas Toyota only required eight, and so Toyota became Toyota. Sticking with the Japanese, Honda. Honda bears the name of its founder, Soichiro Honda. Honda was a precocious mechanic who started the Honda Motor Company in 1946 to build small motorcycles. Although the motorcycle business got off to a slow start by the 1960s, the business had become one of the world's largest manufacturers of bikes. In 1963, Honda introduced its first production automobile, the Honda T360 pickup. And the rest, my friends, is history. How about Dodge? Brothers John and Horace Dodge were gifted machinists who began a Michigan bicycle company in the 1890s. Eventually, they sold this business and began creating transmissions for Olds in 1902. And then Ford in 1903. However, they longed to create cars of their own, so in 1913 they left their lucrative supplier positions at Ford and started working on their own car designs. The brothers soon had cars that were the second hottest sellers in the country, and they became fabulously wealthy. Germany, Mercedes. In 1897, Austrian entrepreneur Emil Jirilnik began ordering Daimler cars that he could drive in some of Europe's quickly growing auto races. It took a few years, but by the dawn of the 20th century, Jirilnik had a number of Daimlers that he adored driving. He often raced under an assumed name when driving these cars. He took on the name of his 12-year-old daughter, Mercedes. In 1900, Jirilnik worked out a deal with Daimler to order 36 new cars on the condition that the cars be all called Mercedes. Daimler agreed and the famed luxury brand was born. Lexus. Toyota, that's Toyota, not Toyoda, went to its ad agency with an image consulting firm when it needed a name for a luxury division. At first, they decided on Alexis, but it was gradually evolved into Lexus. I've heard the other story too, that Lexus, L-E-X-U-S, is short for Luxury Exports to the United States, because that's where they all went to start with, but that's another story. And of course, Mazda. According to Mazda's website, the brand name is borrowed from the Zoroastrian religion, Ahura Mazda is the Zoroastrian god of reason, who granted wisdom and united man and nature and the other gods. Zoom, zoom. Finally, Buick. I know we don't get many Buicks in Australia, but this is an interesting story. Scottish immigrant David Dunbar Buick was an inventive fellow before he ever got into the motor game. He created a more efficient way of manufacturing enamelled cast iron bathtubs. Buick began toying with engines during the late 1890s and started forming engine companies. Of course, they failed. He tried again with the Buick Manufacturing Company in 1902. Buick's cars were terrific. His pioneering use of overhead valve technology made them tough to beat. But he had trouble actually producing and delivering them on time. As a result, he always needed to find new investors to advance him cash. And eventually, his company was sold out from under him to General Motors founder William C. Durant. In 1908, Durant gave Buick the heave-ho and a $100,000 severance check. Buick tried to parlay this money into a great fortune by investing in oil fields, but he didn't have any luck. When his attempts to get back into the car business in the 1920s floundered, he ended up working as an instructor at the Detroit School of Trades. That venture didn't go well either. The school demoted him to receptionist. Crikey. When Buick died in 1929, he was flat broke. That's it. That's enough for me for one day after a story like that. There's a little insight into how some of the cars got their names, particularly, of course, Ferrari's wonderful prancing horse on the one leg with the uplifted tail. And there we have it for another week, I think. Thank you to the late, great Mr. Tony Joe White. He might even come back next week for a few more little tunes. We talked about Daniel Ricciardo and how he went to the New Zealand, original New Zealand team McLaren, now owned by the English, of course, giving up the chance to drive for Ferrari. But we all know why now. We're all much better informed. We had a look at the Porsche, the electrifying electric Porsche, with the electrifying electric price, and we put the zoom zoom into the Mazda logo. Thanks very much for your company. The show is written and produced and pronounced badly in the Sydney studios of Radio 2RPH, and I look forward to your company again next week when, as usual, we will talk about something completely different but probably got wheels on it. Until then, you take care of yourselves, you have a happy new year. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.